May it please the court. In previous arguments that concern this issue, the question has arisen as to where this court, in its Bethurum opinion of 1877, reached the conclusion that the constitutional ban on the laws retrospective in their operation should be limited to civil causes of action as opposed to criminal causes of action. And I think the starting point in how the court got there is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Calder v. Bull, which really set the standard for the ex post facto provision that appears in the United States Constitution. In Calder, the court noted that the phrase ex post facto literally means that a law shall not be passed concerning an after the fact or thing done or action committed. But the court went on to say that when you read that term literally, it has no meaning. And while it didn't really say so, what the implication of the discussion is that the term is so broad that there has to be some sort of limit or boundary placed on it in order to not unduly affect the government's ability to pass necessary laws. So the court looked back in time to Blackstone and found that ex post facto had acquired a technical meaning as far as making something a crime that had not been done before, increasing the punishment for a crime, and there were a couple other prongs to that definition. The court went on to find in Calder that ex post facto is limited strictly to crimes and punishments and has no operation on civil causes of action, although there's nothing in the term ex post facto that would so limit it. The court also observed that if ex post facto had been intended to secure personal rights, private rights from being affected, then other provisions in the Constitution that concern the payment of debts and the restriction against laws that impair the obligation of contracts would be unnecessary and improper because those provisions also dealt with retrospective laws. In other words, each provision of the Constitution is thought to have some effect and some significance. We don't put provisions in that are simply redundant of others. Now, in Bethurum, this court looked at the history of Calder, adopted the same definition of ex post facto, adopted the same understanding that that applies only to criminal laws. And it noted in doing so that ex post facto, the bars on ex post facto laws and laws impairing contracts found in both the U.S. and Missouri constitutions are literally retrospective, but that those terms have been given a technical construction over the course of history. The court found that the ban on retrospective criminal laws was full and complete in the ban on ex post facto laws because that historically had been understood to be the proper means for dealing with retrospective criminal laws through that ex post facto.
You know,
provision.
In looking at Bethurum, it doesn't cite anything. And you notice in the ex post facto, they talked about Blackstone. They talked about the history of what ex post facto meant.
They took a lot out of Calder.
But Bethurum really just said this is the technical meaning of retrospective, but it didn't actually cite anything for that. And the definition about vested rights and affirmative doesn't talk about civil versus criminal. Where did that come from?
Well, you're right. I haven't been able to find, like I said, a single source that just comes right out and say that. But
or
I think it follows.
Is there any source that said, I mean, I understand and I understand the reasoning on both sides of this, but it seems to be the first case ever to talk about it, said it was well established without cites here. And nobody in any of these five cases has cited anything earlier where that derived from.
I think it's an extrapolation of the reasoning that's used in Calder. Again, we look back and say, even though ex post facto has a literal meaning and isn't restricted to crimes and punishments, in looking at the purpose of that provision for not punishing people for things that were innocent when committed, that's the proper understanding of that. That goes back to England, goes back to Blackstone, was carried over by the U.S. Supreme Court in Calder. The Missouri court wanted to do the same thing that the Supreme Court in Calder did, was to give effect to these three different provisions in the Constitution, ex post facto, impairment of contracts, retrospective.
And again, retrospective clearly duplicates impairment of contracts. So to that extent, it is duplicative.
To a certain extent, although I would note that the Leak case that came down a few years after Bethurum, and it's cited in my brief, said that, in fact, and it didn't explain it, but it did say that impairment of contracts and retrospective, here's what it said. A marked distinction existed between laws impairing the obligation of contracts and laws retrospective in their operation, and both were included for that reason. Bethurum said the same thing. When you take all of these together, it's clear that retrospective was meant to cover cases that were not covered under the other two. It wasn't meant to duplicate or swallow up the others, but was intended for that reason.
I think you have more arguments other than it's, I mean, I know your brief doesn't depend solely on the argument that it doesn't duplicate impairment of contracts, because certainly there would be a very strong argument on the other side that it is duplicative of that.
To an extent.
But you have additional reasons why you think nonetheless it was intended to do something other than fill in all the gaps that were not covered by ex post facto and impairment of contract.
Well, I do think that filling in the gaps is the main reason, because that was something that the United States Constitution had not done. And you look at cases that involve things like taxation, would be a prime example of something that would be a civil proceeding that could have a retrospective effect, but certainly wouldn't come within the impairment of contracts. I think what the court was saying is we've got this unified system where we deal with retrospective criminal laws through the ex post facto clause. We've got this little carve out for impairment of contracts, but then other civil causes of action that deal with things that are non-contractual fall under this retrospective. And again,
isn't the whole premise of your argument today that we deal with only some retrospective criminal laws through ex post facto, and that this is another kind of retrospective criminal law which is not included within ex post facto, but you also don't believe is included within the no retrospective laws provision? Why does it deal with only retrospective?
Well, again, I go back to the discussion in Calder about the historical purpose of the ex post facto clause and why it was limited to the four categories of things, that was the intent when ex post facto provisions were passed, beginning in England and here. It wasn't intended to cover the whole gamut of any criminal law that might be retrospective.
Right.
And we did it. It was limited that way for a reason, because it was felt that was the appropriate limitation on criminal law.
And I don't think anybody's raised, I probably wasn't clear in my question, so I'm
sure.
I don't think anyone's suggesting ex post facto has a broader meaning, or that impairment of contracts has a broader meaning.
Right.
But retrospective laws, or laws retrospective in their operation, was added in Missouri and not elsewhere. Clearly it was to include something that wasn't covered by those two prior categories. Why, again, would it have to be only civil things not covered by those two prior categories and not criminal, if you could explain?
Because I think, again, the Thurum, I think, adopted the same rationale as Calder, is that the ex post facto clause sufficiently limits the operation of retrospective criminal laws, and there's no need to go beyond that. It serves the purposes that were intended when ex post facto provisions were first put into place, and that it was not meant to be a broad-ranging provision that would invalidate criminal laws beyond the ex post facto clause. Because again, I don't think the intention was ever that the government could never look back at a past behavior as a marker for future action. It's just that you can't go back in time and punish someone for something they did that was legal at the time they did it. That was the main concern that prompted the ex post facto clause. I think the courts in Calder and Bethurum recognized that is the limit that we want to go to in protecting against retrospective criminal actions. So I think it is based on that historical understanding, as reflected in those cases, that this provision, to give effect to all of them, they all serve a different purpose. And the purpose of the retrospective was to do what the United States Constitution did not, and that was to cover non-contractual civil matters that would have a retrospective effect. And the debates, I think, do reflect that to a great degree. Again, the fact that attempts were made in 1875 to take out ex post facto and impairment of contracts and replace it with retrospective on the grounds that retrospective would cover the whole range, that was defeated. And to give retrospective an interpretation to where it covers criminal laws would essentially write ex post facto out of the Constitution, because a retrospective ban on criminal laws would cover everything that's covered under the ex post facto clause, in addition to things that perhaps were not. So we don't construe the Constitution in a way that renders any of its provisions meaningless. And to say that retrospective does cover criminal actions, I think, would have that effect.
And why does the same argument not apply to impairment of contract? If you apply retrospective, the retrospective prohibition only in the civil context,
Well, that, and perhaps that goes to the way that that retrospective has been defined, because it has a specific definition, much the same way that ex post facto has. So it's, it covers a limited class of civil cases that fit within that definition. There's not a lot of discussion about impairment of contracts, so it's hard to get a real sense of what that provision means. The only real distinction I found in any of the cases is that impairment of contracts, that prohibition does not go to the remedy of the under the contract, but only to vested rights that have accrued under the contract.
And Dovey Phillips, right. Which modern case and the sex offender case that got mm-hmm. into all these issues, said that you cannot, it's retrospective because that statute at issue in that case affirmatively required the person to register mm-hmm. Solely based upon past conduct, or it was right. a criminal offense. Is that right?
Right. The civil and regulatory obligation to register, and I
so
think that
here,
was
So here, for instance, if this law had said before you can enter a park, you have to sign a register, that would be a violation of the no retrospective laws, because it would require, and it's a criminal offense if you don't.
If the registration serves some regulatory effect, like the sex offender did in helping law enforcement keep track of people doing something like that, then it would be subject to that retrospective analysis. Now, obviously, if it's retrospective as to that person, they can't be criminally prosecuted because they're not
so
subject to the
requirement. A lot of buildings require you to sign in. What if a building said only prior sex offenders have to sign in? And if you don't do it, it's a criminal offense.
Well, that's a private building, I assume. Or are you talking about a state law? There'd have to be a law.
Yeah, state law would say that.
Again, you can make the argument that the requirement to sign in is retrospective, but as far as the criminal penalty goes, unless if the requirement to sign in is invalid because it's retrospective, then obviously you can't be criminally prosecuted for something you're not required to do under the Constitution. So I don't think the two conflict with each other in that respect. And I see I'm out of time. I'll address some other points later. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I appear here today on behalf of Jason Peterson, who was charged in originally in Ray County and had his case changed by change of venue to Carroll County for violating the statute that requires sex offenders to not be present in the boundaries of a park that contain playground equipment or to loiter within 500 feet. We filed our motion to dismiss, saying it violated his right under Article 1, Section 13 of the retrospective ban under the Constitution based on our reading of RL and FR. And we've come to the court today for the second time to argue this case and to bring to the court's attention what we've learned since the last time that we were here. And I believe counsel for the state, Mr. McPherson, brought up the reading from what he learned about ex post facto under Calder versus Bull. And in the reading in Bithurum, what the argument about retrospective has, what we've learned from that. And in his brief, he points to the fact that Delegate Gant argued at the 1875 a constitutional convention that the ban on ex post facto law was unnecessary because his recommendation to the constitutional convention was that retrospective covered it all. We didn't need the obligations of contract and ex post facto because the ban on retrospective was broad enough to cover all of those things. So in his mind, he's saying in 1875 that this covers that. So he's including criminal law as well as civil bans, which is in a contravention to what is stated in Bithurum, that it's only civil, that it has this technical meaning. And actually in the Honeycutt brief, which is it covers this point much better than mine, my brief is that it talks about the language in Butherum as being technical and surely they meant this and literal meanings and evidentially is supposed to mean this. And that's what they're using as their supporting documents to say the technical meaning is only civil. And I think that's what you were asking about, is where do we learn this from? And they're not saying that there's a case that points to this. They're just saying that that's our understanding. But the contradiction to that is our constitutional convention, when Delegate Gannett gets up and argues, hey, it means criminal.
And I think Mr. McPherson, when he gets up, might say, but they rejected his arguments. Does that mean they rejected his interpretation? What's your response to that?
Well, I have a whole bunch of responses to that. One is, it looks to me like they reached a compromise and they put them all together instead of selecting one over the other. Not that they picked one that was better than the other, is that they brought the convention together and brought in all the parties and made a big tent and put the language in there for everybody.
Do you agree that this is a criminal statute?
I do. It is criminal in nature, definitely, because
and
it.
Do you think it has any regulatory effects, such as trying to regulate who enters parks and who doesn't?
It absolutely does. I mean, it creates a burden on Mr. Peterson and others in his class of offenders that have to register to go find out where these parks are. And it requires them to not loiter within 500 feet of them or not be present in them. In our case, if it were to go to trial, the facts in his case are that he's on a road that goes through the middle of the park. And whether that's a public thoroughfare or not, you know, that's what we're talking about in our case. The facts of our case is just there's a road through the middle of it, and he's driving his vehicle through it.
And it's... Forgive me because of all the cases, but is your client the one who received a 3-year suspended execution of sentence?
Yes, it's a Louisiana case from where
so
his prior.
So he actually was charged with a crime and convicted of a crime?
Not in this case. No, that I think that would be Mr. Wade that actually got convicted. But my underlying offense was the sentence, actually.
Okay, so. And this case, his charge was dismissed?
Yes, it was dismissed on that.
Why do you think this is criminal in nature and not civil?
Oh, because of the general criminal punishment that occurs. I mean, it has a civil component to it. I mean, it's quasi in that nature, in that it puts a ban to him participating. But the remedy is, you know, the criminal proceeding and charges that are filed.
Well, that was true in Doe v. Phillips too, right? If you didn't register, you were criminally charged. So it was a criminal statute in that sense.
In that sense,
behavior, and so it was civil in that sense. Does it have to be one or the other, or can it have aspects of both?
Oh, I think it's an aspect of both. I think that's why I would refer to it as being quasi-civil, because it has elements of both, you know, or quasi-criminal. I mean, it's almost, it has a little bit of both, because of the burden that's placed on offenders to go out and find these parks to determine whether or not. And that's that other thing about the statute that's a little strange, is that you've got to somehow determine whether there's playground equipment. Because if there isn't playground equipment, it appears that that's not an offense. So without visiting the park, or you're going to have to go ask somebody, hey, is there playground equipment at this park, and rely on what they tell you, because you can't be there and you can't loiter near it.
So the conduct that is criminal here is only criminal because of your status as a prior offender.
Correct.
Otherwise, it's not criminal.
That's correct.
How, if at all, should that affect how we decide this case? And if we said you couldn't do that, how would that affect, say, right to bear arms and other...
I think you just follow the precedent of FR, which says, you know, that you can't live within 1,000 feet of school or have the tenants that they put on for Halloween, the regulations they placed on those things. I think that case tells the court how to follow it. I think it's the precedent in the case. I don't think that Butherum is somehow precedent in this case. I think when I was here last time, you asked, Judge Fisher asked whether or not, you know, since the issue hadn't been briefed before, you know, we don't rule on issues that haven't been briefed before. And my argument, my response was that it had been briefed and argued. They just hadn't used or tried to use Butherum as some sort of precedent in the case. But all that really, it was decided on other grounds, so I don't believe it is precedent. I think that what we're talking about here is how you're going to apply the meaning to the word retrospective. Are you going to use the broad, expansive language that is required, I believe, under these constitutional interpretations? Are you going to use the technical definition that they discuss in Buthurum that
that there is some difficulty in drawing the lines if retrospective is applied to criminal cases and Pride as it was, this area of law is confusing at best as to where the laws are drawn? Or do you disagree with that?
I think the technical analysis that's set up in FR determining the burden on the, you know, way it works out in that case of determining whether this is actually retrospective as applied in that case.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Under the retrospective ban, would it be prohibited from the legislature passing a statute that said convicted sex offenders cannot be teachers?
And making it a criminal statute versus being a regulatory.
Under your interpretation of retrospective, it applies to both. So it doesn't matter whether it's criminal or civil, does it?
Well, that would be a difficult question to answer. You're saying that they've just passed a statute that says teachers cannot be sex offenders.
Uh-huh.
I believe that as a future applies, and that is more of a
because suddenly there would be an impairment to someone who's a convicted sex offender that they no longer have that as an option as a profession where they otherwise would have.
Well, I think you get into the regulatory end of it as in a licensing end, where they have opportunities to maybe be reinstated, but they're suspended, much as our profession does for certain types of offenses where you become suspended, revoked from your license.
And that's what I'm asking, is
I would say that there's a system that's set up for that, just like it is for our profession, where you could seek reinstatement.
Well, there are existing cases, and I can't call it to mind, but one where someone was not allowed to work in the environmental area if they'd had a prior environmental violation. They couldn't then get a license to do something on them. We said that was not a violation of the retrospective laws because it had to do with ongoing safety, or the dam case where we said it was not a retrospective law and we added in requirements for the safety of dams because there were continuing safety problems. Here it wasn't just based on you were a bad dam operator before, but the dam still kept water behind it going into the future. But would that apply to teachers and students? How would that apply?
Well, I don't know that it necessarily applies in that sense, because I think that there's a different system that's already set up for that, to follow that way, that it is, to argue whether that is retrospective or not would be dependent, of course, on the facts of the case and actually the language of the statute. But at that point, we're going to be talking about the licensing and whether they have an opportunity to come back and get licensed to become a teacher again, or is it just an all-out ban and you could never appear again? And that's what something would have to work out that way.
So one aspect of this law, I mean, I would assume there's some playground equipment somewhere in Forest Park in St. Louis. So if there is, then the prescribed person could not go to Barnes Hospital, could not go to SSM because they're within 500 feet.
Like they certainly can't loiter there.
What?
They can't loiter there at the
loiter would have been in the waiting room.
Right.
Something at Barnes Hospital, that's loitering. You can be there 3 hours.
Right.
Or if you're at SSM. SSM is within 500 feet of Forest Park. So if Forest Park has some, again, I don't know, but if they have playground equipment somewhere in the 1,300 acres of Forest Park, then they can't go to Barnes Hospital. And they can't be treated at Barnes Hospital nor at SSM?
But under this statute, you are correct. And I think that's even similar to Mr. Wade's case, you know, where the way he was arrested is being at a, I believe, fishing some distance away from where the playground equipment was located. So his would be just like that. You know, he'd have to learn and figure out before he went anywhere, is there a park nearby? Do I have to worry about that?
And so if someone was injured and the ambulance drops them off at Barnes Hospital because it's close, somehow they have to warn the ambulance driver not to drop them off at Barnes Hospital?
That seems to be the burden that is on the offender in this case, to go out and learn all of those places that they should not be.
The statute has a requirement of knowingly. So they have to knowingly be present in the park or knowingly be loitering. So doesn't that answer the question that you've raised, that they would have to drive every inch of the park and look for playground equipment, or so they have a knowledge element that has to be proven by the state, isn't that correct?
Well, of course that is an element that appears, but you would also have to know, you know, you would have to know when you register that, hey, I can't be in the parks or playgrounds, so I got to know where these things are, so I don't find myself arguing in court, I didn't know. You know, I need to know so I can avoid those situations, so I don't get arrested, so I don't get handcuffed and taken to the jail and have a $50,000 cash-only bond, and, you know, where my argument is going to be, I didn't know. So
isn't the effect of this statute to regulate your client's conduct so they can't enter parks? Because, I mean, the conduct is not criminal. It's only criminal because they do it as sex offenders. So, in effect, it's a way of regulating where they go and how they go about it, not of regulating not of punishing otherwise criminal conduct.
Well, they have to regulate their conduct at parks with playground equipment.
Right.
So that's what there seems to be the effect of this statute to know.
Well, and based upon prior cases, that's where a lot of these crimes occur. I mean, that's where child abductions with some frequency, as opposed to other places, that's where children are abducted.
Well, and that might be the case, and then we may have to pass statutes to prevent them from being in churches or, you know, places like that, because that's where those cases occur as well, you know. So then we're doing a statistical analysis of where these type of crimes happen and then passing statutes that address those. Even if those, and I think I addressed in my brief a little bit some of the theories behind those statistics that you're talking about. So to honestly address those, if I could finish answering, the statistics, you know, of whether those are true or not, depends on, and also further, what other kind of conduct are we going to regulate based on those statistics.
But if I understand, you're not saying there's no rational basis, at least in this argument, you're not saying there's no rational basis for those laws going forward. You're saying it can't be applied retrospectively to your client.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
And perhaps those are actually the more appropriate ways to challenge these statutes, are through things like rational basis, due process, whatever other kind of theory other than just retrospectivity.
Well, but that's not what our Constitution...
There's
right,
no rational...
But what I'm trying
only
to,
rational retrospective laws are okay is not what it says.
No,
it
but,
says
but what, no I'm, what I'm trying to suggest is if the court agrees with us that retrospective does not apply to these class of cases, that does not mean there's no other means of attacking them, that there's no other potential remedy, at least not expounding on the merits or non-merits of those challenges.
Well, I'm asking you to address the second issue, which maybe I wasn't as clear, which is what is the true nature of this case? For instance, in the sex offender cases, the Supreme Court looked at the cases and said, what is the real intent of these laws? Is it civil or criminal in nature? Mm-hmm. And we look at its effect as much as its label. And so I'm asking here, when the conduct is only criminal for sex offenders, and what it's going to do is regulate where they can go and what they can do, and it's criminal if they go places the state doesn't want them to go, isn't that as much a regulatory law as it is a criminal law?
Every criminal law, I suppose, in the broadest sense of the, has a regulatory impact in the broadest sense of regulatory. It regulates your behavior. I cannot go out. I can't go out and rob a jewelry store. I can't kill
only
somebody.
Sex offenders can't rob jewelry stores. In effect, this would be.
It's
done because
it's a class of cases that goes to that, but I don't think that transforms the nature of the statute. It prohibits certain conduct and enacts a criminal penalty for engaging in that conduct.
But
and
only for certain people.
Only for certain people, but for forward-looking conduct nonetheless. And you know, off the top of my head, I don't know if there are other classes of people that necessarily fall within. Well, actually, there are, because we've got the cases involving convicted felons being barred from possessing firearms.
Correct.
So there are.
Excuse me. The U.S. Supreme Court has determined that those don't violate ex post facto laws. Correct.
That's right.
And when the to the extent that the Supreme Court has looked at sex offender laws, they've drawn different conclusions based upon the whether the severity of the crime. When they look at whether or not a statute is civil or criminal in those cases, they're not doing any retrospective analysis. They're purely looking at the ex post facto analysis.
I'm sorry, were you referring to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, that was the question I just had to ask.
Of course, the U.S. Constitution.
It was, and they said those are really civil, even though they have criminal components. And
right.
At the time, it was argued they're really criminal and they're
right.
really civil. And so I'm putting the same question to you. Is this not, in some sense, really civil and not criminal, just like the sex offender statutes, because its purpose and effect is to regulate conduct? It does so by putting you in jail if you violate the prescription of your
conduct.
Well,
as I go back and recall the discussion in Doe about the regulatory nature, it wasn't so much regulatory in the sense of regulating conduct. It was regulatory in the nature of how it assisted law enforcement in performing certain functions in terms of keeping track of sex offenders and where they were. So it was regulatory in that sense, not in the sense necessarily that it regulated behavior, which is something that every statute, criminal statute, does, again, in the very broadest meaning of that word.
Isn't it more regulatory in terms of its protection of the public, like commitment of sexually violent predators,
well,
being a civil procedure?
Well, and of course, SVPs are civil proceedings and not criminal, but again, that's not something where a criminal penalty is ever imposed. We have a person.
Confinement.
It's confinement,
confinement
for treatment.
So confinement in and of itself is not necessarily a criminal penalty.
No, just like in the mental health system, we have confinement that's not necessarily criminal. So no, confinement does not in and of itself make it a criminal penalty. But I think these statutes do fit the classic example of a criminal statute that prohibits conduct and makes a felony offense for engaging in that conduct.
But then again, these statutes are to protect, with a noble goal of protecting children from people that might harm children, and children would be at playgrounds, and so that's it's the purpose of the that you're passing these laws to protect children.
I think just like all criminal statutes are designed to protect the public, either as a whole or certain segments of it as necessary. Yes, I'd agree with that.
I have a feeling you'll have lots more opportunities to address this
further.
Case is submitted.